Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. It's June in New England, and the farm stands are opening up. It's too early for corn and tomatoes, but you can find local asparagus and lettuce. So why don't we come back to an occasional theme of the show, food and agriculture? American food has been in the news, too. One dead cow was found to have mad cow disease. Not to worry, said the corporate-controlled government and media. The cow was never destined for the national food supply. This reassurance would have been more reassuring if a substantial percentage of cattle were tested for the disease. But they're not. Only a minuscule percentage of cattle is ever tested. So finding one diseased cow ought to set red flags flying. Mad cow disease is transmissible to humans, where it becomes the fatal Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease and destroys your brain. If the bad news was worse than the system pretended, the good news was not quite so good. Some supermarkets announced that at least some of the hamburger they sell will no longer contain pink slime. The beef industry has another name for the stuff. Whatever. Pink slime is highly processed scraps of who knows what swept off the slaughterhouse floor, with ammonia compounds added to kill some of the deadly bacteria. The irony is that the pink slime, though not exactly meat, is possibly less dangerous to your health than the actual meat in mass-produced hamburger. But let's not focus just on beef. We now have a centralized, globalized food system, controlled by a very few huge corporations, which are subsidized hand over fist by the federal government, using money we have been taxed to provide. The agricultural system is much like our centralized, globalized, subsidized banking system, and it serves the public every bit as poorly. But food contamination is not the only problem with our industrialized agriculture. Maybe not even the worst problem. There's the destruction of our soil. There's the massive pollution that agriculture produces. There's its huge, huge need for fossil fuels. Fuel to ship the food out to and in from all over the globe. Fuel to power all that farm machinery. And fuel to produce those agricultural chemicals the system requires, herbicides and pesticides, and especially artificial fertilizer, which is made out of natural gas. There's also our declining health caused by the system's producing and our consuming too much of the wrong kinds of food. Then there's, but don't get me started. In fact, let's let Michael Pollan get started. He's the journalist and writer who wrote the very good book on our food system, The Omnivore's Dilemma. This week and next, we'll hear a good talk Michael Pollan gave in 2006, soon after publishing the book. It's every bit as worth hearing now as it was then. This week, in Part 1, Pollan explains that and why the corporate industrial global food system is not only bad but unsustainable. Then he looks at one alternative, organic agriculture. And he finds some bad news there, too. Turns out that some of the big players in organic agribusiness are going down many of the same bad paths as conventional agribusiness. But first, let's hear Pollan's excellent analysis of why factory farming as we know it is simply unsustainable. Speaking in Davis, California, here is Michael Pollan.
Because I want to talk about the importance for our health, for our security, for our environment of developing local food systems and developing a truly sustainable agriculture, which we are a long way from. Let me start out with that word, sustainability. It's a not very attractive word. It's kind of a pallid social science-y word and much abused. But it really pays. I'm a writer, and one of the first things I do when I explore a subject is think about the words and what wisdom might be embedded in them or what wisdom may have been forgotten in the way that they're used. There's a great line somewhere in Confucius that before you can begin to make progress and think, you need a process Confucius called the rectification of the names. And I think we need a rectification of this word sustainability. So what is it? And what does it mean to say that something's unsustainable? Let's dwell on the negative for a little bit. Well, it just doesn't mean that it's good or bad, or we like it or we don't like it. It means something very specific. Unsustainable means that something cannot go on the way it has been going on indefinitely. Why? Because it is consuming or destroying the resources or conditions it depends on. So collapse or radical change is inevitable. We need to remind ourselves of that. There is much at stake here. That system is a kind of zero-sum game, dependent on subtracting from the world or from resources or from people in a way that can never be corrected. So what does that mean with respect to our food system? Because I would argue that our food system is unsustainable, our industrial food system. And I use that term to really mean all the kind of the food that shows up in our supermarkets, by and large, with a few exceptions, and the food that ends up in our fast food restaurants. You know, in the book, I tell the story of that food chain by looking at one crop. And one of the great surprises for me in trying to follow back our food from a meal was that when it came to mainstream industrial conventional food, I kept ending up, whenever I followed that hamburger, that soda, even those French fries, I kept ending up in the same place, which was to say a farm field in the American Middle West where they were growing corn and soybeans. This was a real shock to me. I did not realize the extent to which these two plants, out of all the hundreds of thousands of wonderful edible plants there are on this planet, that we have come to depend on for our food. And indeed, today, 80% of our calories are coming from just four or five plants. I don't know exactly how many come from corn and soy. And I focused on corn because it was such a such an important building block of the fast food nation. And I looked very closely at that whole corn industrial complex. First, I need to say I have a great deal of respect for corn as a plant. Indeed, it has completely outwitted us at this point and gotten us probably to do more for it than it does for us, because it's doing a lot of bad things to us. But corn as a food is wonderful. Corn as an industrial raw material or as a food product is another matter. But, you know, it has one plant, by virtue of its genius and its ability to manipulate us, has conquered our land, our food system, all our animals, all our food animals, and it's even conquered our bodies. But we grow 12 billion bushels today that we transform into all manner of processed food, feeding it to our animals, fractionating it, distilling and refining it into things like high fructose corn syrup. And it's this oversupply of corn that really is responsible for the fact that sweetness and added fat are so ubiquitous in our diet and in our bodies. In effect, with this plant and this, what I argue is a very unsustainable food system, we've taken our food system off of the sun. Agriculture, of course, begins as a solar enterprise, and we've kind of hooked it into the fossil fuel economy in a way that is deeply unsustainable. So what does it mean to say that corn system is unsustainable? Well, start with energy, okay? And I'm not even going to list all the ways in which it's unsustainable. We used to, before the rise of industrial agriculture in the last century, we used to get 2 calories of food energy for every 1 calorie of fossil fuel energy we invested in agriculture, driving tractors or whatever we were doing. Now, with the way we eat today, 10 calories of fossil fuel energy are required for every 1 calorie of food that we eat. We are using oil to grow corn. We are using corn to make oil substitute. That's a particular scale of absurdity maybe we can get into in the question period. But our food system now accounts for, and the estimates vary from like 15 to 24%, but the best ones I've seen is about 17% of our fossil fuel use is going to feed ourselves. To give you some comparison, 18% goes to personal transportation, to driving around. So food is a very important part of the energy problem, a very important part of the climate change crisis. Indeed, each of us, Americans, eating the way we are, which is to say a very high meat, highly processed diet, are adding, simply by our eating decisions, 4 tons of carbon to the atmosphere every year. It's not often talked about as part of the energy dilemma. I think it was one of the real lacks in an otherwise terrific film, Al Gore's film, Inconvenient Truth, that he never really addressed the food part of the problem. But it's a large part of the problem, and in a way, it's one of the more tractable parts of the problem. Our trade in food is exploding right now. More and more food is traveling further and further. You've heard the statistics. The average item of food in your supermarket has traveled 1,500 miles. We are, as an economist pointed out, we are selling sugar cookies to the Danes and buying sugar cookies from the Danes. Another absurdity, as he pointed out, you know, it would be a lot more sustainable to simply swap recipes. I think it's a very good suggestion. So this can't last. We know we are reaching the end of our oil supply, and we cannot continue to eat it the way we are. Pollution. There are many kinds of pollution associated with industrial agriculture. There is the pollution of pesticides, 80 million acres of cornfield in this country. Most of it is grown with atrazine, a very toxic weed killer that is in the water in the Corn Belt that we know at concentrations as low as 0.1 part per billion turns male frogs into hermaphrodites, chemically emasculates them. This is in the water supply all throughout the Corn Belt at much higher levels than that. Fertilizer pollution, nitrogen. We put way too much nitrogen, which, by the way, is made from fossil fuels, mostly natural gas. And that fertilizer runs off the cornfields of the American Midwest and runs down the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico, where it has created a dead zone currently the size of New Jersey and growing. This won't last. Our patience for this, I don't think, will last. Health. What about health, this food system of abundant, cheap food? Well, you know, our food system is providing lots of food, but it is not doing what a food system needs to do, which is to say, keep its population healthy. We are not healthy. We are overfed, and we are fed in such a way that we're suffering from an epidemic of diabetes that threatens to make the lifespan of the generation being born today shorter than that of their parents for the first time in American history because of diabetes. Many other chronic diseases as well. This monoculture diet, when you're getting so many of your calories from a very small number of plants that you're essentially breaking down and creating into what appears to be this incredible diversity in the supermarket, but in fact it's corn calories or soy calories of one kind or another. You know, we are omnivores. We know we need between 50 and 100 different chemicals, minerals, to be healthy. And you don't get that from processed corn and soy. With the result that in the inner city, in Oakland, near where I live, there are children who live on fast food diets in West Oakland who come into clinics suffering from things like rickets, diseases we thought we had conquered 100 years ago. Why? Well, they're drinking more soda than milk. They have micronutrient deficiencies because their diet is so monocultural. Well, money. How about sustainability in terms of money? Cheap food, though, it turns out, is really, really expensive. We spend up to $25 billion a year to subsidize this food economy. 40% of the income in the American Farm Belt today comes from government payments, from subsidy checks. So this food is not really as cheap as it looks. We're all paying for it. Food security, and I'll talk more about this later, but having such a concentrated food system raises enormous vulnerabilities to either accidental or deliberate contamination. And we had an illustration of that with the E. coli 157H7 in spinach just a few weeks ago. When you're washing the nation's entire salad in one sink, more or less, in the Salinas Valley at one company, when something goes wrong, and something will go wrong, even at the best-run food plant, many, many people are affected. Hundreds and hundreds of people are affected. And lastly, the last sense, and I haven't talked about the animal welfare, and I haven't talked about labor, and there are many other ways in which the system is unsustainable, but it's unsustainable, I would argue, and this speaks to my theme and my project, Because it depends on ignorance. And a system that depends on ignorance for its survival. And let me tell you what I mean by that. It means that when people know what they're eating, when they know how that hamburger was produced or how that chicken nugget was produced, they lose their appetite for it. People who read Fast Food Nation lost their appetite for fast food. When you look over the high walls of our industrial feedlots and see how the animals live and see how the animals die, you stop eating that food. So you see that that wall is very important to the survival of the system. But walls don't last. We know that. We know that from the fall of communism. We know that sooner or later, people will see. Someone will show them. And when they do, they will turn away from this food system. So it's unsustainable in the sense that it depends on our not knowing.
On New World Notes, we're hearing Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma. He just explained 6 major ways that our standard system of agribusiness is bad, wrong, and unsustainable. These 6 are the huge energy expenditure, pollution, bad human health, the high cost in money, lack of food security, and the fact that the system depends on public ignorance. While we're at it, let's throw in destroying the ecosystem, or more simply, trashing the planet. Clearly, organic farming is a way out. But Pollan goes on to show, organic chain supermarket is still pretty far from the Garden of Eden. Free-range chickens probably spent their entire lives inside a shed. And alas, organic agribusiness is still agribusiness. Here's Michael Pollan.
More and more people do know. More and more people are worrying about the food system. How do we know that? Well, because we can look at their consumer behavior. They're flocking to Whole Foods. They're flocking to the farmers market. They're joining CSAs. Whole Foods is now the fastest growing supermarket chain in the country. How incredible is that? Their growth is rapid. But you know what? Farmers markets are growing even faster. They've doubled twice in the last 10 years. We have no idea how many dollars are being spent there because a lot of people aren't paying taxes. But we can guess it's reached the billions. It is in many ways, you know, it's an underground food economy. It is a lot like the last days of the Soviet Union. So this hunger for alternatives. In my book, after I looked at the whole industrial food supply, I decided, well, I really wanted to look at the alternatives, and I wanted to look at organic food, very important alternative, also the fastest growing segment in your supermarket. It was, when I started writing this book, it was under 1%, and now it's hitting about 3%. It's growing really quickly. And I want to read you a brief passage from the book to leaven all the dark news about what I call the literary genre that's on offer at Whole Foods, which I found very interesting. And, you know, I don't come out of the sciences. I really come out of an English department. So I called it Supermarket Pastoral. And I just want to read you a page or two. I enjoy shopping at Whole Foods nearly as much as I enjoy browsing a good bookstore, which, come to think of it, is probably no accident. Shopping at Whole Foods is a literary experience, too. That's not to take anything away from the food, which is general. You guys don't have a Whole Foods yet, right? In Davis? Sacramento, okay. They're coming. That's not to take away anything from the food, which is generally of high quality. Much of it's certified organic. I'm going to do this one, something's in quotes, because there are a lot of quotes in this. Or humanely raised, or free range. But right there, that's the point. It's the evocative prose as much as anything else that makes this food really special. Elevating an egg or chicken breast or bag of arugula from the realm of ordinary protein and carbohydrates into a much headier experience, one with complex aesthetic, emotional, and even political dimensions. Take the range-fed sirloin steak I recently eyed in the meat case. According to the brochure on the counter, it was formerly part of a steer that spent its days living in beautiful places. Ranging from plant-diverse, high mountain meadows to thick aspen groves and miles of sagebrush-filled flats. Now, a steak like that has got to taste better than one from Safeway, where the only accompanying information comes in the form of a number. The price, I mean, which you can bet will be considerably less. But I'm evidently not the only shopper willing to pay more for a good story. With the growth of organics and mounting concerns about the wholesomeness of industrial foods, storied food is showing up in supermarkets everywhere these days, but it is Whole Foods that consistently offers the most cutting-edge grocery lit. On a recent visit, I filled my shopping cart with eggs from cage-free vegetarian hens, milk from cows that live free from unnecessary fear and distress, wild salmon caught by Native Americans in Yakutak, Alaska, population 833, and heirloom tomatoes from Capay Farm at $4.99 a pound, quote, one of the early pioneers of the organic movement. The organic broiler I picked up even had a name, familiar to most of you, I'm sure, Rosie, who turned out to be a sustainably farmed, free-range chicken from Petaluma Poultry, a company whose farming methods strive to create harmonious relationships in nature, sustaining the health of all creatures and the natural world. Okay, not the most mellifluous or even meaningful sentence, but at least their heart's in the right place. And there's that word, sustaining. In several corners of the store, I was actually forced to choose between subtly competing stories. For example, some of the organic milk in the milk case was ultra-pasteurized, an extra processing step that was presented as a boon to the consumer since it extends shelf life. But then another, more local dairy boasted about the fact that they had said no to ultra-pasteurization, implying that their product was fresher, less processed, and therefore more organic. This was the dairy that talked about cows living free from distress, something I was beginning to feel a bit of myself at this point. This particular dairy's label had a lot to say about the bovine lifestyle. Its Holsteins are provided with an appropriate environment, including shelter and a comfortable resting area, sufficient space, proper facilities, and the company of their own kind. I really love that. Do you know any dairy that doesn't offer that to their cows? As if they'd have to be integrated or something, you know. All this sounded pretty great until I read the story of another dairy selling raw milk, completely unprocessed, whose cows graze green pastures all year long, which made me wonder whether the first dairy's idea of an appropriate environment for a cow included, as I had simply presumed, a pasture. All of a sudden, the absence from their story of that word seemed weirdly conspicuous. As the literary critics would say, the writer seemed to be eliding the whole notion of cows and grass. Indeed, the longer I shopped in Whole Foods, the more I thought that this is a place where the skills of a literary critic might come in handy. Those, and perhaps also an investigative journalist. And those of you who've read the book know that I went and did some of that investigative journalism, although I don't want to dress it up with that word. Let's just call it journalism. And I went to visit Rosie and the organic, free-range, sustainably raised chicken, and I went to visit some of the cows, organic cows, and I was kind of surprised and disappointed to find that organic is in many ways in danger of and beginning to repeat many of the mistakes of the industrial food chain. It is lapsing closer and closer to monoculture, and with animals it's already there. Rosie lives with 20,000 other organic, free-range chickens in a big shed, not at all like the farm depicted on the label. It's a better product than many chickens. They have a few more inches of leg room. They get organic feed, no pesticide in the feed, and they don't get antibiotics, and they're not fed hormones. Do they really free-range? Well, I was very disappointed to see that when I stepped into this long shed, it was 100 yards long and 20,000 birds, and I said, so what about the free-ranging? And the I was going to say farmhand, but these aren't really farms. The CAFO hand said, he said, there's the door. There's a door right there, and there's a door at the other end, too. And I said, yeah, but it's closed. And he said, well, we don't open it till the birds are 5 weeks old because we're really afraid they'll get sick since they're not getting any antibiotics. Which is very interesting. It kind of shows you that doing organic agriculture on an industrial scale is actually more precarious than industrial agriculture because you don't have the tools you need to be growing a monoculture of animals in close confinement. So we don't open until they're 5 weeks old. And I said, okay, and how long do the birds live? He said, oh, 7 weeks. And that's when I realized that the free-range thing was not so much a lifestyle for these chickens. It was kind of a two-week vacation option. And when they do open the doors, they don't go outside. the water's inside, the feed's inside, the flock's inside. They've never been outside. That free-range yard, which does exist, is a conceit. It's a literary conceit for us. It's much like our front yards, our front lawns. It's this kind of symbolic space that nobody actually uses. You know, so organic, there are now organic feedlots. There are now organic factory farms. There are organic cows, many of them from labels that you probably buy and think are really special, are not getting pastured while they're milking. And that seems to me a real shame and a real declension from the ideal of organic. Food miles. I mean, organic is becoming just as processed as anything else, and we are moving toward an era. I just heard today about organic pizza at Pizza Hut. Now, how do we feel about that? I mean, it's a mixed bag. There's something very good about it. It means many more acres of organic wheat and many more acres of organic tomato. An organic Coca-Cola, I could make an argument for. You know, more acres of organic cornfield, not doused with atrazine. But organic Coca-Cola, you know, do we really want to go there? And I don't know. I mean, you can argue it both ways. But actually, organic food in the supermarket is now traveling further than conventional food, more than 1,500 miles. The whole kind of regional distribution system is repeating itself in organics. If you buy local Washington tulips at the Whole Foods in Seattle, those tulips have first traveled down to California to a regional distribution center and then come back up to Seattle, even though they were grown a few miles away. So you see the kind of economic system is repeating itself. And the future of organic, of course, is global. Walmart will get into organic, they're about to, and they will source a lot of their food in China. There are a lot of real questions about organics from China. How organic are they? Stonyfield Farm Yogurt already, again, one of the pioneers, a really good company in a lot of ways, but now they're sourcing organic milk powder from New Zealand because there's not enough organic milk in this country. They're sourcing strawberries from China, apple puree from the Philippines, and blueberries from Canada. I don't think that's the image the consumer has. There are good and bad things about that, and it's very nice that our food dollars are helping take care of the land in China and the Philippines and New Zealand. But I don't think that that's why a lot of us buy organic. I think our goal is to take care of land a little bit closer to home.
And that's part one of a great talk by Michael Pollan on globalized corporate agriculture and why it's got to go. Thanks for the talk to the Mondavi Center at the University of California, Davis. That's wine country, son. Next week, Pollan continues with a close look at one brilliantly sustainable organic farm. And he shows why farming and food need to be relocalized and also taken much more seriously. You'll find free MP3 audio recordings of this and other installments of New World Notes at our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. You'll also find my email address there, and I'd be glad to get your comments and suggestions. Again, that's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, and with two bits of advice. First, as Michael Pollan said elsewhere, if your grandmother wouldn't recognize it as food, don't eat it. Second, elegant to my non-carborundum, and hope to see you again next week. Ciao.